Good evening. Still can't get used to all the daylight. It's wonderful, isn't it? Delicious. So I think we are... I'm not entirely sure.
Page 116.
Believing in nothing. Yeah. 116.
Believing in nothing. In our everyday life, our thinking is 99% self-centered. Why do I have suffering? Why do I have trouble? I discovered that it is necessary, absolutely necessary, to believe in nothing. That is, we have to believe in something which has no form and no color. Something which exists before all forms and colors appear. This is a very important point. No matter what God or doctrine you believe in, if you become attached to it, your belief will be based more or less on a self-centered idea. You strive for a perfect faith in order to save yourself, but it will take time to attain such a perfect faith. You will be involved in idealistic practice. In constantly seeking to actualize your ideal, you will have no time for composure. But if you are always prepared for accepting everything we see as something appearing from nothing, knowing that there is some reason why phenomenal existence of such and such form and color appears, then at that moment you will have perfect composure.
When you have a headache, there's some reason why you have a headache. If you know why you have a headache, you will feel better. If you do not know why, you may say, oh, I have a terrible headache. Maybe it is because of my bad practice. My meditation or Zen practice were better, I wouldn't have this kind of problem. If you understand conditions in this way, you will not have perfect faith in yourself or in your practice until you attain perfection. You'll be so busy trying that I'm afraid you will have no time to attain perfect practice. So you may have to keep your headache all the time. This is a rather silly kind of practice. This kind of practice will not work. But if you believe in something which exists before you have a headache, and if you know the reason why you have the headache, then you will feel better, naturally. To have a headache will be all right, because you are healthy enough to have a headache. If you have a stomach ache, your stomach is healthy enough to have pain. But if your stomach becomes accustomed to its poor condition, you will have no pain. That is awful. You will be coming to the end of your life from your stomach trouble.
So it is absolutely necessary for everyone to believe in nothing. But I do not mean voidness. There is something, but that something is something which is always prepared for taking some particular form, and it has some rules or theory or truth in its activity. This is called Buddha nature, or Buddha himself. When this existence is personified, we call it Buddha. When we understand it as the ultimate truth, we call it Dharma. And when we accept the truth and act as a part of the Buddha, or according to the theory, we call ourselves Sangha. But even though there are three Buddha forms, it is one existence which has no form or color, and is always ready to take form and color. This is not just theory. This is not just the teaching of Buddhism. This is the absolutely necessary understanding of our life. Without this understanding, our religion will not help us. We will be bound by our religion, and we will have more trouble because of it. But if you become the victim of Buddhism, I may be very happy, but you will not be so happy. So this kind of understanding is very, very important.
While you are practicing Zazen, you may hear the rain dropping from the roof in the dark. Later, the wonderful mist will be coming through the big trees. And still later, when people start to work, they will see the beautiful mountains. But some people will be annoyed if they hear the rain when they are lying in their beds in the morning, because they do not know that later they will see the beautiful sun rising from the east. If our mind is concentrated on ourselves, we will have the kind of worry. But if we accept ourselves as the embodiment of the truth or Buddha nature, we will not have to worry. We will think, now it is raining, but we don't know what will happen in the next moment. By the time we go out, it may be a beautiful day or a stormy day.
Since we don't know, let's appreciate the sound of the rain now. This kind of attitude is the right attitude. If you understand yourself as temporal embodiment of the truth, you will have no difficulty whatsoever. You will appreciate your surroundings, and you will appreciate yourself as a wonderful part of Buddha's great activity, even in the midst of difficulties. This is our way of life.
Using the Buddhist terminology, we should begin with enlightenment and proceed to practice, and then to thinking. Usually, thinking is rather self-centered. In our everyday life, our thinking is 99% self-centered. Why do I have suffering? Why do I have trouble? This kind of thinking is 99% of our thinking. For example, when we start to study science or read a difficult sutra, we very soon become sleepy or drowsy. But we are always wide awake and very much interested in our self-centered thinking. But if enlightenment comes first, before thinking, before practice, your thinking and your practice will not be self-centered. By enlightenment, I mean believing in nothing. Believing in something which has no form or no color, which is ready to take form or color. This enlightenment is the immutable truth. It is on this original truth that our activity, our thinking, and our practice should be based.
So he's pointing to two problems here with our practice. One is that we try to be perfect and aim for perfection and think of practice as a vehicle for getting us to our perfection. And the other is to misunderstand about nothing. Misunderstand how things come to be and reify them, make them solid and real. The colors and forms that are constantly arising in life. And believe that they're fixed. Fixed in time, fixed in space. Both of these are mistaken views, you could say. It's kind of strange to talk about believing in nothing. I always say that Buddhism is not a system of belief. Ideas are so extremely helpful to us, but they're not real. They help us aim ourselves, you could say. They help us point in the right direction, the direction we want to and need to be going. But if we begin to make them absolute, then we've missed and then we become confused. And as he says, so much of our confusion is based around me. What about me? What does this mean for me? I want this, and I want that, and I want more. It sounds tricky when we talk about it, but actually when we sit, it becomes more obvious. Once we're sitting, quietly sitting, calmly sitting, we realize there's nothing to miss. And all those I wants and I should haves and I would have and etc. Are as immaterial to us as they really are. Of course, then we get up and walk back into our dream unless we're mindful. We walk in and out of our dream life, in and out of this self that we make for ourselves, in and out of the forms and colors of the world. We can't negate the forms and colors of the world. That's Buddha itself, enacting itself. But if we try to solidify, hold on to the rain, hold on to our good fortune, or whatever other kind of fortune we have, the whole display becomes distorted for us. It was in Shambhala puts out a Dharma quote, Snow Lion Publications puts out a Dharma, two Dharma quotes, one from the Dalai Lama and one from some publication or other of Tibetan teachers. And the one this week talks about this, exactly what Suzuki Roshi is saying, that even if the condition of what is this cannot be grasped with the mind, and that's what he's saying, if you try to think about it, then you're far away from the truth of it. If you start with enlightenment, start with not knowing, if it cannot be grasped with the mind, the whole manifestation of the primordial state, and the primordial state is his way of talking about the, what does he call it? Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I guess. Primordial state is a very wonderful way of pointing to the beginningless beginning, or beyond the beginning, or beyond the source. The primordial state, including our karmic vision, our vision of ourselves and our life, does nevertheless exist. The condition of what is can't be grasped. But the whole manifestation of all of it does exist. We can't say it doesn't exist. All the various aspects of forms, colors, and so on continue to arise without interruption. I love the image of that, of the continual kind of flowing and flaring of form and color. That's what our life is. That's what our experience of life is. In fact, we're not sure we know what life actually is, but we experience it as forms and colors continually flowing, coming into being and fading away. All the various aspects of forms, colors, and so on continue to arise without interruption. When we find ourselves in contemplation, in Zazen, this doesn't mean that our impure vision just disappears and pure vision manifests instead. If we have a physical body, there is a karmic cause for that. So there would be no sense in trying to abandon or deny the situation we find ourselves in. We just need to be aware of it. if we have a vision of the material, physical level of existence, which is the cause of so very many problems, we need to understand that this vision is only the gross aspect of the colors, which are the essence of the elements. That what we see, sort of in passing, our in passing view, is the sort of clumsy, gross aspect of life that is extremely complex, intricate and delicate, and really ultimately unknowable. It's very humbling. And yet that humbling aspect is one of the biggest helps to us. I should have brought the address. There's a website, maybe some of you know, on Tiny Earl. It's got some letters and numbers that go with it. But it is an illustration of time, space, and size. And it starts with the Big Bang, and then, you haven't seen that?
No, it sounds interesting.
It's amazing. It's amazing. It takes a long time. It's a very contemplative experience, because from the Big Bang, it goes to the first sort of little stars, and then it takes a long, long time for anything more to happen, and then the whole development of the universe. So you see something kind of vague and weird, and then there's a long empty space, and you just see the timeline going, 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 and then suddenly something starts looming up, and it's a galaxy or a cluster of stars, or and then it takes ages to get to the Earth, just ages. And then you get to the Earth, and then you see from the whole Earth to down, down, down to the tallest buildings, to the biggest animals, elephants, to down to the tiniest, tiniest virus. I think it stops at a virus, maybe even smaller than that. Probably. Very, very, very small. So, but it's a very contemplative kind of exposition of this, the colors and forms of life, even though it's in black and white. And it's just shapes. And you can play with it. You can make it bigger or smaller. You can skip around if you want to. So you have some kind of control over it. But in the end, you just feel so small. So small, and experience how enormous time and space and the shape of things is. How vast. I think about this a lot just in terms of survival, because I think human life, probably all life, I guess the life of gnus and giraffes and and amoeba are the same, of big effort. And a lot of the big effort in human life is to cope. And it takes some kind of chutzpah to feel that we can cope, that we can manage. And then in the course of trying to manage, we begin to feel more and more that we've got some kind of grip on things, and that we know what it's all about. It's important to have that kind of confidence, or some kind of confidence. But I've come to see more and more how important a kind of blind trust is in our life, more than the facade of complete competence that is so easy to develop as we try to walk with balance through life. It's hard to say, I don't know. It's much easier to try to feel that we do know and try to get to know and try to build up a kind of way of being a knowing person. But to be awed by the world, to be humbled by life, to admit how little we know, is closer to what Suzuki Roshi is talking about here, how Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha manifest, how Buddha life itself, how the primordial forces of being come into being as our life. So believing in something which has no form, no color, which is ready to take form and color, rising up, coming to birth. I talked to someone who, and told them about Donna Lynn's ordination, and he said, oh, now she must be clear. She must be all clear. That's wonderful. I said, well, no, that isn't what it is. It's not all clear. It's just as much walking in the dark as ever. But it's service, dedicating one's life to the service of each moment. The one awake moment that we each have each moment, to this moment. So this is an important chapter. It's one of those, you know, believing in nothing, and people say, oh, those Buddhists, how can they say that? It's ridiculous. But it's the most important thing. Questions? Dan?
So I always try to summarize these things and ask, you know, how would I do that? How would I live that chapter? And the thing that came to mind for me is, in summary, was if you he says, don't believe, quote, in anything. Well, okay, how about one thing? How about you believe in openness? You know, being able to see. And then drop your definition of what that is. And then there is not what you think it is, but what is. And yet, how hard it is to even that exercise, how hard that is to do.
You're making it too hard.
Yeah, it's very hard, that last step.
Yes.
To drop your definition of openness is incredibly difficult.
It's better to just be open. No, you don't have to imagine openness and then try to get there. Mm-hmm. It's much easier just to be there in the first place. And then you can think about it. You know, sometimes it's helpful to consider what state we're in or what our view is. But it's better to actually be that state and be that view and then consider it.
Kind of like reverse the order?
Yes.
You tend to want to think reality into our favor. And here you're saying, let reality show itself and then,
exactly,
if necessary, think about it.
Exactly.
I like your exercise better. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that the scientific method of creating conjectures, what they call hypotheses, about what might be real, and then being open to seeing whether the data actually say, oh, it is that or it's not that. I think that's, for me, that's the real essence of the scientific method, is that there's nothing that says that they know that if they don't find, if the data don't show what they hypothesize, they're completely willing to reject that.
They're eager to reject it and excited about the next truth.
Yes.
Yes.
And I think in some senses people think the scientific method is very closed. Oh, we're looking for this.
No.
And on the contrary, it's extremely open.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering, you know, is that one way to resolve, quote, the dichotomy that people frequently think that exists between the scientific method and practice?
Sure. I often say this is that the mind of Zazen is the mind of science. That's one place where we actually do that. The arts is another one. You know, it's a kind of show me what it is, you know, and expose ourselves to and get excited about something and think this is the way. I've read several in Science News. There were several discoveries that turned out not to be true, and the writers quoted the scientists as being thrilled, because there was a whole other thing that opened up that they'd never thought of before, even though their months and years of work were trashed by the discovery. They didn't care, because they were after the truth.
I actually heard a guy talk one time. He gave a talk and then said that near the end of his talk that a few things had happened. Number one, he had gotten his PhD. Number two, partway along the research that he'd been doing, he disproved his own PhD, and he didn't have to give it back. And number three is that for the latter work, he won a Nobel Prize.
Cool.
So he actually won a Nobel Prize essentially for disproving his work.
That's wonderful.
Which was, yeah, and you're right. And he was kind of like thrilled to be able to say that.
Yes.
You know, in summary. It was
yes. Yes.
It takes quite a person to be thrilled about something like that. It's like the whole Tibetan sand.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. And then
mandala.
Yeah. Exactly. Yes. It is a mandala. And it's completely disposable. Anything is. That mandala experience is amazing. If you ever have a chance to see it and you haven't, do. It takes days with this little scraper and this little tube, little silver tube, and they let little grains of colored sand, and they make the most intricate designs, these huge ones, as big as a circle here. And you really get, if you go and see it over and over again and you watch it grow and it becomes more and more beautiful, it glows, the colors are so beautiful. And then they have a ceremony and they bless various avenues and gates and do various things to it, and then they start sweeping it up. And the woman standing next to me at the Asian Art Museum keeled over. She fainted dead away. And I knew how she was feeling, because it was just like watching somebody die. Whew. And what they do is sweep it all up and carefully put it in a vase and take it to a river or the ocean and let it go. And it's a blessing to make it. So you have this incredible forms and colors, shapes, that shines into everyone's life. And then you sweep it up and it goes back. It's a very beautiful practice. It kind of tells us about life and death without preaching to us. You know, tells us about beginnings and endings and comings and goings without saying, this is how it is. No, you just get to watch it and go, oh!
I was having an argument with my husband about something we both felt really deeply about. And we had a big difference of opinion about it. And at one point he just said, okay, that's it. I don't want to talk about it anymore. And I felt really upset by that. So we were just locked. Mm. And this is the first time this has happened to me where I just kind of got this, that nothingness. It just kind of, I mean, we were driving back from supper. It was supposed to be a nice night out. We had this argument over supper, and we're sitting in the car and just totally locked against each other, and that feeling of the void, just I felt it like being on the cushion, and I just felt like this this compassion for both of us, and that also that it was the strangest feeling of like this doesn't matter. And yet, it's really important. It was the weirdest combination of.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, and this is really important. And. That was the void that helped. That was the help just then.
And that's the scientific mind, you could say, when you let go of your own. Or at least you can see your own grasping nature of trying to make it your own, that you win. And at the same time to have a much bigger view, a much more generous view of how the whole thing is held and is unreal. In one sense, it's completely unreal. It's just words. So it gives a kind of scientific freedom to actually look at the situation and try to understand it better. If we just hold on to our own point of view, we can never understand it.
Well, I think too that what really struck me about this was that it didn't feel like that was through my effort. Because
yes.
What you just said, I mean, you know, I like to think that I'm skilled at doing that sort of thing, like trying my best, but you know, the truth is obviously. So it felt like this wasn't of my own effort, that this just.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It's wonderful. Right on the nose. It says 10 o'clock, but it's really 8. I scared myself at supper. But I overshot the whole thing.